This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. There are few journalists who can speak with as much authority about the state of newspapers today as Pete Hamill. Since his first job as a cub reporter at the New York Post in 1960, Hamill has worked as a columnist, rewrite man, war correspondent, and editor. He's also a prolific novelist. His writing style, like his colleague Jimmy Breslin's, is not the conventional objective news voice. It's often been described as direct as a punch in the face. Hamill has covered the streets of New York. He's reported on the Vietnam War, also Northern Ireland, Lebanon, and Nicaragua, Washington politics, mobsters, and celebrities. Just last year, he was appointed editor-in-chief for the New York Daily News, with the idea that he would resurrect some of the qualities that made tabloids great back in their heyday. The experiment only lasted 8 months. In his new book, News is a Verb, Journalism at the End of the 20th Century, Hamill writes about his experience at the Daily News and what's wrong with newspapers today. Hamill says in the public's mind, tabloids like the New York Post and the Daily News are synonymous with trash, and that it didn't used to be that way.
When I was a young reporter breaking into the New York Post, the columnists included Murray Kempton, Mary McGrory, Marcus Childs, in sports, we had Larry Merchant, Leonard Schechter, Jimmy Cannon, all kinds of very good writers who did not write down to the audience. They didn't think the audience was stupid. They thought the audience was smart, and they wrote to that audience. They were there for that audience. What's happened in the meantime is that they've gotten much more coarse, much less trusting of the audience. And I think there's reasons for that. I think there is a growing gulf between the people that run newspapers and the people that read them. Too many editors live in the suburbs. Too many editors are separated from the people they hope will read their newspapers, and therefore become much more dependent on things like focus groups and studies and all this other semi-sociological gobbledygook instead of getting on the subway and seeing what people are reading and talking to them about what they're doing.
Isn't part of the problem, too, though, that our cities are changing? I mean, the people are much more mobile. They move around. You don't have as many lifelong Chicagoans or Philadelphians as you used to have. Cities don't have this firm identity, perhaps, that they once had when the population was more stable. And it is true that while editors and reporters more and more live in the suburbs, also newspaper readership of city papers lives in the suburbs. There's just a completely different framework and context for the print media.
Well, if the newspaper gives up on the central city, then I think they make a big mistake. In a city like New York right now, where we're in a particularly good period, where crime has been cut way down, where the middle class that used to flee when their kids got to be 5 or 6 years old is now staying, because even the public schools in certain areas are much better, that in the end, the central city has to be the focus of the newspaper. You have to be able to say, why is it not working? And do something about it. Use the muscle of the newspaper to analyze what is not working well and what the answers, what the remedies are. To say, for example, if you take a New York City newspaper and lead your sports section with golf, you've obviously decided that the suburban mind is, and the suburban concentration of attention has shifted. But if you're out in the subway and you're taking the subway, you know, you don't hear people sitting around talking about golf. You don't hear people in the bars of Brooklyn or Bensonhurst or Queens talking about golf, except for occasional phenomena like Tiger Woods. So I think you have to be much more focused on that inner city. There are very good newspapers in the suburbs. In New York, Newsday is a terrific newspaper. But they are specifically focused at those suburban concerns. And I think, by the way, in New Jersey and other suburbs, the Bergen Record and others, excellent papers. But the New York City paper better not become suburban, or it's saying, we're gone. We're out of here. We're another hole in the ground. And I don't think that's the ambition.
When you took over as editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News last year, you tried to resurrect some of the things you felt made the tabloids a great read in the past. And one thing you insisted on was covering immigration.
Right.
Management wasn't too happy with this. I guess they felt it wasn't a sexy story. What was your argument in favor of covering immigration in newspapers in a sustained, in-depth, and front-page way?
Well, there were two arguments, basically. One is it's a great story. Anything that repeats a cycle that a city like New York has gone through before, 100 years later, and shows that that cycle is still full of energy and vitality, that must be covered. There was also much evidence to show that the immigrants were, in fact, adding to the social cement of the city. They were revitalizing certain neighborhoods, buying houses, fixing them up through sweat equity, if that's the phrase, and changing the city. So you had to know something about that. They were also changing the culture. Immigrants always bring some new thing, whether it's food or music or language, into the culture. I have heard Koreans call their stores bodegas. I saw a headline in one of the Spanish papers about 4 months ago, un político dice no es un schmuck. You know? A politician says he is not a schmuck. In Spanish, there is a mixture of language and that creates a sort of linguistic and cultural vitality you got to be aware of. Is that page one? Of course not. That's not what I'm saying, but it is at least as important as the latest homicide. It is a major factor in a city with 1 million immigrants in it to cover that 1 million immigrants with some kind of intelligence. The second part of it, beyond it being a great story, is that it's good business. You might not get the immigrants to buy your paper today, but there's an accumulative effect of good coverage. Joseph Pulitzer knew this when he was running the New York World, and the reason he knew it is he was an immigrant from Hungary, and he knew that even though the immigrants didn't maybe read the New York World that morning because they were in it, that long run they would buy it, and that's in fact exactly what happens, because you're not just talking for the immigrants, you're talking for their children.
You also tried to make the paper, the Daily News, more literary. You serialized Norman Mailer's book, The Gospel According to the Sun. That's a fictional exploration of Jesus. Now, you did choose to serialize that book at the same time that I think the New York Post was serializing a book about Sammy the Bull Gravano, the famous mobster. So you were setting up a kind of a high road and a low road situation.
Well, I wish that was not the plan, because I certainly would have run Sammy the Bull's book, too. In other words, what I'm saying is I think there's room for certain kinds of fiction in newspapers. New York is where most of O. Henry's stories were published. There's been a tradition in Europe for years of people like ranging from Alberto Moravia to Umberto Eco writing for newspapers. I was saying we don't think the audience is stupid. We think the audience is smart. And there was a terrific reaction to that serialization. That doesn't mean I would not have run Sammy the Bull, too. Not the same week, maybe, but...
Let's talk about celebrity journalism for a bit here. You really are a master of celebrity profiles. You've done series on a number of people. I'm thinking of a wonderful profile you did on Frank Sinatra. How did you and your editors handle the celebrity stories differently in the past? I'm thinking in the 60s and the 70s, when to run them and where to run them in the paper and what detail to go into.
Well, I think I'm not against celebrity journalism as long as it's journalism. In other words, don't take a handout from a press agent and put it in the paper. Don't let the press agent tell you where it's going to run. Don't let the celebrity say, I will talk to you, but you can't talk about my life, my wife, my girlfriend, my lover, my dog, or anything other than my movie. You know, we're not in the business of helping somebody sell their movie or the book or anything else has to be journalism to start with. In celebrity stuff, and it's one of the reasons for the title of my book, news is a verb. They have to do something. Madonna shops is not interesting. Madonna throws Sean Penn under the Third Avenue bus is a story. It's got an interesting verb.
Pete Hamill is my guest. In the course of his long career in journalism, he's been a reporter, a columnist, a war correspondent, a rewrite person, and an editor. He served as editor-in-chief both for the New York Post and just last year was editor-in-chief for the New York Daily News. His new book is News is a Verb. It's about the state of journalism today. We're going to talk some more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer and longtime newspaper man Pete Hamill. His new book is News is a Verb, about the state of print journalism today. One of the things you say you were first taught was never use the word tragedy. Never say
it's
a tragedy.
That's true. I thought of that when I watched again this Princess Di coverage and heard that this was one of the great tragedies of the millennium. I said, shut up, quiet, get out of, get off. The great piece of advice was never use the word tragedy. Let the reader say this is a tragedy. You don't have to tell the reader how to feel. A lot of what's going on in some of this writing right now comes from not trusting the reader to get it. And that comes, I think, from television, where they have to put soundtracks on things to tell you what you're supposed to feel. And so you get a lot of writing that all feels like it's in italics because they don't trust that the reader can get it, you know. And when I was breaking in, I fortunately was in the hands of a lot of people older than I was, who thought the reader would get it. Trust the reader. Reader's not stupid.
That sounded like you guys had a lot of fun there.
We sure did.
Wild times. A reporter friend of mine told me, while I have you here, I have to ask you about the time the guy working at the copy desk died.
Oh, yeah. It was a fellow named Herbie Negler who was the news editor, which would be at the New York Post, the guy in charge of the whole copy desk, sitting next to me one night. There was a fine old older fellow named Dexter Teed, who had a wonderful Dickensian name and looked just like what a Dexter Teed should look like—a little sort of tiny mustache and a bow tie and suspenders and very careful fellow who wrote the press digest every night, which meant he would tell you what the editorials and the other papers all said. Herbie Negler, the news guy, had one of the strangest accents I ever heard. It was very nasal and guttural and Germanic. And I'm sitting next to Teed one night when Teed fell forward, hit his head on the typewriter, and died. At which point, the next sound I heard was, copy boy, get me the clips on Dexter Teed. And if Dexter Teed was still alive, that's the last thing he heard, because it was all over. You know, the newspaper, it was a rough room, you know, I mean, to work at a newspaper in those days. I mean, all they saw, they didn't go rushing to help this guy. They had to start figuring out, can we get the obit into the paper?
You tell a lot of stories about those days, how drinking was just part of the workday. I like the one you have about Murray Kempton, a legendary New York reporter.
Right.
One election night, he sent his copy down to the editor's desk one line at a time.
Right. And then finally, the editor, whose name was George Trow, a wonderful man, because Kempton's office was on the one floor above the City Room. Finally, Saul told the copy boy going up and getting Kempton's. There were no computers or anything like that. Ask Mr. Kempton how much more. So the kid ran upstairs, went into Kempton's office and said, Mr. Kempton, Mr. Trow wants to know how much more. At which point Murray lifted up his bottle, looked at the bottle and said, oh, about an inch, and sent the kid on his way.
Novelist and longtime newspaper man Pete Hamill is my guest. You were a columnist for a number of papers, all throughout your career, you have a really distinctive voice in your columns. One memorable column you wrote was about the death of Robert Kennedy, who was a friend of yours. You actually saw him get shot. What were the circumstances that you were there when he was assassinated?
I was in California actually covering election night. And I knew Bobby for several years fairly well. And I was with the group up on the stage as he said, "We'll see you in Chicago," and so on. And I was there as the decision was made to go into the pantry of the, this is all at the Ambassador Hotel, to go through the pantry to cut back to the elevators. And I was walking backwards, watching him with several other reporters. It's one of the weird skills you develop in the reporting business is walk backwards so you can watch the person you're covering. And he turned to shake hands with somebody, and then suddenly, pap, 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 these small, short, almost cap gun count, sounds, and there was directly to my right Sirhan Sirhan with the gun. Nobody knew who Sirhan Sirhan was at the time. Nobody knew what Palestinians were at the time. I mean, it was a different era. You know, we thought it was maybe some nutty Cuban or something. And a bunch of us jumped on him and slammed him up against the steam tables. He kept firing the gun for, you know, some very long seconds, which is why, as people tried to push the gun down, and that's why some of the people who were behind Bobby got shot in the legs, because the gun was being pushed down. And then I saw Kennedy on the floor, and he had this sort of blissed out look on his face. He was still alive. He lived for 24 more hours, and he had blood on his throat and on his fingertips. So I thought he was shot in the neck. It turned out that he was clearly shot right behind the ear and must have brushed his hand up there in a reflex and brought the blood to his fingertips and his neck. But looking at him, I had seen something like that before. I had covered a fight with Emil Griffith and Benny Perret. And Emil Griffith had knocked out Perret and left them on the floor, and that same kind of almost sweet, accepting look on his face was on Kennedy as it was on Perret that night. And I knew he was dead. I knew he'd never come back. It just wasn't going to happen. And the whole scene was outside in the ballroom turning into pandemonium at that point. But inside, it was calm almost right away, because Jesse Unruh, who was then the boss of California Democratic politics, kept saying, "We don't want Dallas here. We don't want Dallas here." You know, he was afraid, I think, that Sirhan would be beaten to death right in the spot. And we didn't have Dallas there.
It sounds as if through this whole chaotic episode that there was a part of you who was a friend to Robert Kennedy and also a part of you who was a reporter, was registering every detail.
The reporter was what was taking over. Somehow I held on to my notes from that night, and I can see, even in the handwriting on the notes, great shifts. Suddenly there'll be small, tight writing, walk backwards, walk into, and then the words blam, 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 in larger lettering, you know, trying to in some way show what was there. Then the writing gets smaller again. The reporter takes over in those situations. The next day was not easy, though, and I had a hard time after that happened. For a variety of reasons, one was a professional one. I had made a mistake of being a friend of this man, which was a fine personal thing to do, but not a good professional thing to do. I don't think it's good to be friends with public figures if you're covering them. And I've never been friends with a politician ever since. I don't mean that I'm an enemy of any of them, but what they do and what I do are different. And you can be an insider and be one kind of a journalist, and you can be an outsider, and I think it's better to be an outsider. But on a simple personal level, I was devastated by it. I had the only writing block of my career during that summer. Until I came to New York and ran into Paul O'Dwyer, who's a wonderful politician here, an old, wonderful, white-haired, Irish, semi-radical, I guess. And he said, "What are you writing?" And I said, "Nothing, I got this block." And he looked at me and laughed and said, "You're not important enough to have a writer's block." And I said, "You know, you're right." And I went to work the next day.
Pete Hamill, I really enjoyed talking with you today. Thanks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Pete Hamill's new book is News is a Verb. It's part of a new paperback series called The Library of Contemporary Thought, put out by Random House. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.